Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Mari Pack.
And I'm Christine Stoddard.
Hey, Christine, I wasn't here last time. What's going on? What is this?
This is a Radio Free Brooklyn show that I started and you were smart or dumb enough to join.
I think both are equally true answers.
Yeah, so Lisa, Dr. Lisa, who is a host at Radio Free Brooklyn, is fabulous, and she had a fundraiser one day. Her friend Dallas said, "Christine, I can't be a mermaid for Dr. Lisa's fundraiser. Could you go be a mermaid?"
Mm,
so yes. I dressed up as a mermaid and helped Dr. Lisa collect money for her show, and met some really cool people and thought, hey, I could start a show on this community station. Why not do it about women? And that's what this is. It's going to be a weekly talk show where normally we will have a different guest from the community who will come in and talk about the badass stuff she's doing as a Brooklynite for Brooklynites.
Christine, you and I are gentrifiers.
Yes.
So we are part of the problem.
Yes.
We come from middle-class families in Northern Virginia, and we are artists, so it's like a double threat to the Brooklyn community.
Yeah.
So why did you move to Brooklyn?
I have always wanted to live in New York. My dad is from New York. He grew up in Rye. He moved to the Lower East Side as a teenager. My grandparents lived here. My grandpa lived here until he died. And I've just always had stars in my eyes about this place. But my father, he started teasing me because back in high school, I said, I'm going to move to Brooklyn. And with a family that's from Westchester and Manhattan, to him, that was just the biggest insult. Like, why the hell would you move to Brooklyn? You're going to be a bridge and tunnel person. And I said, Daddy, this is where all the cool art stuff is happening now. He's like, I don't believe you.
Brooklyn's a dumpster fire.
Yeah, why would you live there? Like, Daddy, you're just being so narrow-minded. You don't understand. But I visited friends in college, mainly people who were living in Bushwick, NYU students, NYU grads, and I said, yeah, that's where I want to live one day. And I tricked my husband into doing it.
Plus.
Yeah. What about you? Why are you here?
I got bored of Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
I wish I had like a big exciting story, but I had been living abroad for 3 years. I was in Canada and then I was in Israel doing all manner of witchcraft. And I ended up back in Northern Virginia with my parents for 6 months, like doing yoga and freelancing and just like hating my life. Like, I always explain to people when they're like, why do you hate Northern Virginia so much? I'm like, you know that kid from Into the Wild who went into the wild and died in a bus in Alaska? That kid's from Northern Virginia. Like, there's something.
He is from Burke, right?
He's from Annandale.
Whatever. Another shithole.
Yeah, another awful shithole. Like, there's just something about that place that makes you try to claw your way out with both hands. And so I was just in Northern Virginia, and I was like, you know, I bet I could live in Brooklyn, and came here for a weekend, and we're like, yep, this'll do. But what kind of responsibility do people like you and I have, you think, to the community that's already existing here?
I think it's the same community that any middle-class educated person, particularly any person of privilege, should have wherever they live, and that's just to be the best person you can be.
Be the best version of yourself!
Be the best version of yourself. Help your neighborhood. Get involved with your neighborhood. Maybe it's your community at large. Maybe it's your borough. Maybe it's not your block. But know who your neighbors are. Know what's going on. Who's running the schools? Who's running the local government? Where your tax dollars are going? Volunteer. Know the churches, know the schools, know basically what's going on. And yeah, I struggle with that. Just got here a few months ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Gotta get your bearings.
Yeah, so I'm still trying to get my bearings, but eventually I want to work up to that point where I know who the heck everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to make this a decent place to live. It is a decent place to live, but just continue to better the community in whatever little way that I can.
Yeah, improve the lives of the people that were already living here, not just the lives of us and all of our friends.
Right, exactly. I want to go to all the fun bars and restaurants.
Oh, and totally.
I want to support community businesses, local businesses in that sense, but I also want to use the talents I have, which are not really in business at all.
Nope. Sure ain't.
Just try to use those specific talents to help the community.
Awesome. So,
Christine, wait, whoa, no.
What?
You have to answer that question, too.
Fine.
What do you think our responsibilities as gentrifiers are?
I think that, okay, so that is a... I asked that question to you because I feel like I don't know how to answer that in a way that I feel really satisfied with yet.
Yeah.
Because I feel like on the surface, my answer would be it's to improve the lives of everyone in the borough and in the community and not just people who look like me. But how do you do that without being a white savior? How do you do that without coming in and say, hey, you guys live in a shithole, I'm here to improve it?
Right.
Because that's not really any of my business.
Yeah.
I moved into Bushwick, and I moved into a sort of the far end of Bushwick that isn't totally gentrified yet, and I see that creeping into our neighborhood. I see all these, like, you know, I see these cool bars, and you have a platform right down the street with this cool little coffee shop, and I see it encroaching upon the area, and I know it's because people who look like me and come from backgrounds like I do are moving into this area, and my neighbors are awesome and funny and sweet, and they always, like, whenever I'm, like, taking my laundry down, they always, like, stop and chat with me. Like, they are inviting me into their community, and just by the nature of me being here, I am sort of bringing me and my interests and the will of this sort of, like, you know, like, middle-class hipster artist identity to this area, and they didn't ask for it. So
yeah.
I think that, to be the most honest I can be, is I don't know how to do that yet.
Right.
And I'm trying to figure it out. I think that being a part of the community is important, and making the community a place where we all have a seat at the table is important, but I'm definitely still learning how to do that and open to being, like, called in on how to do that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think one of the ways that we can avoid the white savior complex is by making genuine connections with people, and that's so corny sounding, but
yeah. Go out and make friends
your
neighbors.
Go out and make friends, introduce yourselves, get involved. No, but seriously, there are so many people who do just come into a neighborhood because the rent is cheap, and they don't even say hello to anyone
who's been
living there for years. They don't say hello to their neighbors, and that just seems like, at the most basic level,
really
such
shitty.
And it's such an easy way to get to know people, because eventually, if you say hello and good morning enough times, you're going to start, as neighbors, doing favors for each other, having conversations, and just learning about the history of the neighborhood, just who's been here, why their families came here 10 or 20 or 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you shouldn't just move to Brooklyn because you want to be surrounded by your college friends. And I know that it's very hypocritical of me to say that, because that was certainly one of the inspirations for moving here, coming to a place where I did know creative people.
Oh, totally.
Were already living.
No, that's why I moved to Brooklyn and not to, like, San Francisco.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, I wanted, like, I'm 26. And or at the time I was 25, and I was just like, I'm tired of making so many friends. I've met all the friends I want, everyone else, GTFO. And, like, unfortunately, I've continued to make friends because I'm so affable and charming. But at the time, I just wanted to go to a place where I knew I'd have some sort of family, and Brooklyn was that place.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this show was to just get more involved at the community level, try and figure out who were some of the women here, the unsung heroes who are just doing fantastic work, whether they're teachers or they're artists. With the two of us, it could easily become an art show.
I know, but that's the fear. Wait, so, Christine, really quickly, what do you do? How do you make your dollar monies to pay for your gentrifier Brooklyn rent?
So to pay for my gentrifier Brooklyn rent, I just live off of my husband's money. Very rich, very rich motion graphics designer husband.
Yeah, he's just been raking in that motion graphics oil money for years now.
Yeah, and I just live the rich life, you know. He, like, hand feeds me grapes every day.
Yeah, he, like, cleans the bathroom, too.
Yeah, he cleans me.
You haven't cleaned yourself in years.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't held a sponge in a very long time.
No, that's why your hands are so manicured.
Yeah.
They're very beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm gonna go to the David store in a little bit and get me one of those husbands, and then that's the last time you're gonna see me with hands like this. I have princess hands after that.
Yeah, right now you have street urchin hands. Is that what you're saying?
Yep, I have witch hands for witch hands. Mixing dirt.
No, seriously, I mainly write. I'm about to start a contract with Mike.com as an arts writer. And in addition to writing essays and reported pieces, I do some advertising, like advertorial content. And I do art projects as well that don't make me a heck of a lot of money, but they still bring in a little bit of money. I'll do community work, actually, community artwork, and I often will get an artist stipend for that, and I'll sell prints of my work, I'll exhibit my work, and occasionally sell original pieces. And that's how I bring home the bacon.
Yeah.
What about you?
What do I do? So I moved to Brooklyn. Oh, this is like so betrays my type of like geopolitical identity. I literally had no job. I'm just like, I got some money saved up. Worst case scenario, I move back in with my parents. And I just moved to Brooklyn and I was doing some freelance work as a copywriter. And then within a month or two, I got a job working as a copywriter and like a content writer for a camera company. And I still work for them. And then for the non-monies, I am a poet right now, and I'm currently putting together a collection. It's like a memoir in the form of poems I'm writing to other people. So it's sort of like trying to grapple with various forms of intimacy that aren't just romantic intimacy. So I feel like I've gotten to this really nice place in my life where I feel very whole, and I've lived in a lot of places, I've met a lot of people. And I'm very at peace with the love I have for all of these people that I've drawn into my life. And actually, Brooklyn feels that way a lot, too, because in all these places that I've lived, everyone comes through New York at some point. And people I knew when I was in Richmond, when I was in Toronto, when I was in Australia, when I was in Israel, all come through this space. And that makes me feel very whole. It makes me feel like the corners of my identity are being held together. So the collection is about that. But yes, for the dollar monies, it's all about that sweet copywriting. Selling people their computers, their cameras, you know, all the hip stuff.
Yeah. So they can go do creative things.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Exactly. So like that's in dream world, that's what I like to think of that we're doing, is that we're creating this place for like other artists to be able to express their art. And like I write a lot about like, here's how you use a prime lens because it's gonna make your pictures much, much better.
Very pretty.
Yeah, very pretty.
Very pretty. Buy this lens.
Exactly. Buy this lens. That's actually one of the problems with my boss. She's always like, Mari, this is a really great idea, but like, why don't you try selling something? And I'm like, oh yeah. That's what we're doing. Like,
this isn't poetry.
It's not poetry.
Oh.
Like,
yeah, no, I will often forget that with reported pieces, because when I write essays for money, sure, I might have a deadline and I might have to rush and I might not be able to mull over sentences as much as I would like, but there's still a certain amount of artistry there, whereas with reported pieces, they just tend to be, or they should be, like, straightforward, to the point, objective. And I, God, my first paragraph is always like, and I was sitting there at the bar, like, Christine, cut the description. Nobody cares.
Make it a novel. Make it a novel.
You do not need to set the scene.
Oh my God. No, so that is
a reported piece.
That's such a problem. So in your everyday life, do you have a problem with like narrativizing what is happening and making it more romantic than it actually is?
Yeah, no. And I think that, well, that's why I moved to New York, right? Stars in my eyes, like living the New York dream. I'm going to move to Brooklyn to be an artist. Yeah, no, definitely. Everything has to fit into a story arc. Everybody's a character. Everybody has... And yeah, everybody has motivations in real life, but they're not nearly as clear-cut as they are in novels.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true, and I often find myself trying to do just that, trying to fit people into neat story arcs and try... And not only does it not work, but it's cruel to them. And that's when I'm realizing the older I get is, or like the way I love people or fall in love with people, very often I will fall in love with the story of them. And that is an insult to them and to me. But how do you separate that when your sort of impulse to write and to beautify and to make something narrative and your impulse to be honest?
I don't know that I succeed. I don't... It's one of those things that I know I'm guilty of, and I'm still just trying to figure out how to best approach it. I'm just naturally a romantic person, and I'm going to... I mean, I married my high school sweetheart, okay?
But he's very nice.
He is a very nice man, but I do fall in love with certain characters and ideas and stories, and that, yeah, that's one of my biggest character flaws, is that sometimes I get so caught up in this story that I'm telling myself that I forget to live a regular normal human life and treat other people like regular normal human beings instead of characters. And I think as gentrifiers, it's unfortunately very easy to fall into that trap too, whether you want to be on the quote-unquote good or at least better side of gentrification or the quote-unquote bad or worse side of gentrification. You can champion the people of Brooklyn, right?
Champion the people of Brooklyn.
Yes. The Jewish people, the Puerto Rican people, and this is their story, this is their history. It's like, well, why don't you let them introduce themselves and tell you what their story is.
That's why you gotta get a radio show and bring people in.
Yeah, and interview them when it's not a holiday week.
No, Thanksgiving.
Yes, Thanksgiving. Yeah, I mean, it's really the same question for you. I'm sure you fall into these romantic traps regularly.
All the time, and it's the literal worst. I mean, I was in a situation recently that you know about where I sort of fell in love with the idea of someone, and it was bad news, capital B, and I couldn't let go of it because I'd created this story over like a series of months that, and this is why you do not fall in love with other writers. I know, and like I literally tell myself that every time. And every time I'm like, okay, but this writer is going to be the one, don't worry. Like this, I've picked this one. This is the good writer. It's just don't, if you can possibly help it, if you were a writer, just find a nice engineer and just settle down with them. But because I just fallen in love with the words of this person and the story of this person and the story that they had created, the story that I had created. And it was just it. So when it had to end, it was just this doubly crushing feeling of losing the story of the person that I really thought was going to have a different ending, and then losing the actual person. And once again, it's not really fair to them that I forced them into the trap of being the character that I'd asked them to be. But it still sucked. And I don't really know how like romantic people like us can almost like preserve our sweetness, because I want us to preserve our soft hearts. I think that there's something really brave about that, about continuing to be romantic and to make art and to be honest. But I think at a certain point, you really just have to open yourself up to being really hurt and being really screwed over, and that's just like part of the journey.
Yeah. We probably hurt the worst. Just yeah. In the sense that that artistically inclined people, not even necessarily people who are artists, but just people who have artistic sensibilities, mm-hmm. are so sensitive, and we fall in love so deeply, and we experience pain in such a raw way. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. an honest way, because we don't...
What a good point.
Well, just because, again, we are not fully honest with ourselves if we keep selling ourselves on these lies.
Yeah, buddy.
These stories, these characters, these ideas that we're creating as artistic people. Yeah, we just have to be careful about getting hurt. And I think about that with the New York dream. Like, I doubt I will live in New York my entire life. Mm. I highly doubt that.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, at what point is that dream going to fade? How far am I going to fall? How hard am I going to fall? And will moving away from New York one day feel like a failure? Or will I move away once I feel I've really accomplished something, I'm satisfied, and I'm moving away just because it's the right time in my life to do that?
I feel very strongly that cities are like people in that way. So like all of the cities I've lived in, I identify very strongly as like relationships I've had. Like, I think I've told you this before, that like my relationship with Toronto is that like Toronto's probably the love of my life, and he turned out to be a banker. And that was really, but like a banker who like makes like charcoal paintings and like takes me to like poetry reading, but like is also like really nice to me. And like, I, you know, maybe I dated all these like musicians in other cities, and I just like went to Toronto, and Toronto was like, oh, I'd really like to make you breakfast. And I was like, what? Like, I don't expect that from you, Toronto. And then maybe like Israel was like my like hot fifth cousin, where I'm like, oh, there's something uncanny about this that is too close to home, but I'm like into this also.
Really into
it. I'm like also like really into this, and like I don't know how I feel about it, but I don't know what kind of love of my life New York is going to be yet. And I agree with you, like I don't know, is it going to be like a slow burnout? Because I also feel like living in New York is like being in a relationship you know will end, but that you also know is worth the investment, even if there's going to be pain later. But what's that pain going to look like? Is it going to crash and burn really quickly, and you're always just going to have this hole in your soul? Are you going to slowly wither away, and then it dies to you in this different, equally painful way? Well, like, I'll see you in 20 years, and I guess we'll hash it out.
Fall in love again.
Fall in love again with a different city.
Well, okay. On the note of geography,
yes.
I would love for you to clarify all the different amazing, beautiful places you've lived, why you lived in those places, and just your brief takeaway, your little snapshot.
My snapshot of those places. Okay, so I think it is apt to point out that in my bedroom, I keep maps of all the places that I've lived. And it's funny, like looking back now, sort of mid-20s going into later 20s, I look at the maps and I'm like, what was I doing? How did I want to get away with this? And it was just really important to me when I was sort of in my late teens, early 20s, as it was also important to you, I think, to just toss myself at as many places as possible. And I'm really glad that I did. I mean, now it's looking back, I'm like, oh, that sounds really exhausting. But it also has given me this complete, maybe in some ways, unfounded confidence. Because I just feel like, oh, I've lived there, I've done that.
Oh, yeah. If you can go to a foreign country and survive.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
That's a pretty big accomplishment.
Totally. And I completely get that I was so lucky to be able to do it. And at the time, I don't think I even realized how lucky. Like, I came from this Northern Virginia bubble, and, like, all of, like, you know, my cousins had gone on study abroad trips. And I was like, oh, it's just, like, what one does is go on your study abroad trip. but so, actually, so this is a good segue, that you and I met my first study abroad. You and I met, we both did a program in Scotland.
Yeah.
And So, actually, before I go into, I promise you I will tell you, like, all of my gallivanting, but let's just talk Scotland. Let's just talk Scotland, like, really, really briefly. So I know when I went to Scotland, I went with this, like, sort of strange romanticism of my mother had lived in Scotland as a child for some years. And so even though I don't think we're genetically Scottish, like, at all, I think we're, like, low-class English.
Oh, no! Oh, dear!
Yeah, my mother's family is, like, WASPy Navy brats, basically. But because they had lived in Scotland when my mother was a child, there was this, like, weird cultural inheritance of, like, the British Isles and of Scotland in particular. And so it felt very much in my DNA to go. And so I feel like I was in some ways chasing her nostalgia. Now, Christine, you are actually Scottish or have Scottish ancestors.
Yeah, so my sisters and I joke that we're the only Salvadoran Scottish Americans you will ever meet.
You might actually be, though.
I once met someone who was Irish and Salvadoran.
Really?
His father was Irish American and his mother was Salvadoran, but that was the closest to our mix I've ever encountered. But yeah, so my father is American. He's from New York, as I explained earlier. But his grandparents or great grandparents, come on, Christine. Great grandparents came from Scotland. So Stoddard, my last name is Studherder.
No way!
Yes, it is Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, not Irish Gaelic.
What's a stud?
So
that
a
you're
stud,
herding?
A stud is the horse, the big manly stallion used to impregnate mares.
And so,
he like gets it on with the pretty lady horses. He's like he is the big strong manly horse that they want the baby horses to resemble. So my people basically lived in horse shit, shoveled horse shit, and just raised studs. That's what they did.
Someone has to. And to me,
Air Scotland.
beautiful. And so you went to Scotland with this dream past of, you know, once being a Scottish princess.
Yeah, pretty much. So it was funny because I have two sisters, and one is Mari's age, so she's about a year and a half younger than I am. So she went on this trip as well because our parents said, well, you might as well study. We had a short list of places, right? And my sister and I had to agree on a place. I won a scholarship. My sister from VCU, our school, and my sister had some leftover money from a high school scholarship. And then our parents helped with the flights. And yeah, it was, okay, you can go to this short list of places. And we both said, fine, we'll go to Scotland.
We'll go to Scotland.
We'll do this.
And it was indeed. I thought it was the best. I felt like it was the best.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. I mean, to be there to study creative writing.
It's just the fucking dream.
Yeah, with the novelist, Suzanne Kokel.
She's so great. Yeah. I think about her all the time and her red pants. Because I had a class with her, like, afterwards, like, after Scotland, when we went back to VCU, which is the school that Christine and I both went to. And she taught this class, and I can't remember if Freud was, like, overtly a part of the class. I think it was about fairy tales, but I remember I learned more about Freud that semester than I have ever learned since. But, like, in ways I didn't even expect it to be incorporated. I was just like, Suzanne, you are brilliant. Like, thank you for bringing in penises. Like, I was thinking it. I'm glad you said it.
Yeah, no, she is huge on sex in fairy tales and folklore and the Victorian era. The only book of hers, because she has three novels, I think. I read Breath and Bones, which was gorgeous, but that was very much like a let's have sex everywhere.
Let's have sex everywhere.
kind of book.
Because that one's in like a plague era Europe?
No, that, you're thinking of, gosh, is it Kingdom of Little Hearts? That's the new one.
Oh,
so
okay.
Breath and Bones was the second one, and that was in gosh, late 1800s, early 1900s. I don't remember exactly
when. I don't think people had sex
then.
I don't believe you.
No, well, her characters had a lot of sex.
Okay, so I think they're the only... So I think we are all the descendants of them, because I don't believe that Victorian people had sex. I think that all ancestors were amoeba-born, but I'll believe that maybe Susan Kokel's characters had sex.
Maybe. Possibly. Like, okay, where else did you live?
Okay, so went to Scotland, and then my, like, study abroad that I did my junior year, I went to Australia, and when I was in Australia, why did I go to Australia? I don't even know. I think I was just like, I want to go to a place, and I'm really bad at Spanish, and... I don't know any other foreign languages, and I've already been to the UK, and so I don't think I even, like, put a lot of thought into it. I was just, like, I sort of had this, like, vague idea. I was getting a minor in art history at the time, and I had this vague idea I would go study Aboriginal art.
Ugh, amazing.
And it was amazing, but I was so bad at it. Like, I totally, I just didn't know anything about it, and I remember... Oh, this is really embarrassing, but I'm 100% going to talk about it. That from our final paper, we had to write, like, because one of the things about Aboriginal art is that to, I guess, like, the Western eye especially, it's seen as being very primitive and, like, not beautiful. And we had to write an argument for basically, like, that sort of ethnocentric lens of, like, what is beautiful in Aboriginal art. And you're supposed to make, like, an ethnocentric argument, like, dismantling that. But it was, like, dumb, and I didn't get it. And so I wrote this whole paper about how there are all of these Aboriginal artists who are half Aboriginal because they are the descendants of the stolen generation. And so they oftentimes incorporate, like, Western motifs and Western ideas into this Aboriginal art. So I wrote this paper that was like, see, it's beautiful by a Western eye because it's got Western stuff in it. And my professor was like, fail, that is not the point. And in retrospect, oh, she is right. But at the time, I was just like, da-da-da.
Yeah, but you wrote, so I, for the listeners, I run this literary magazine called Quail Bell. That's quail, like the little bird, and bell, like the object you ring. It's about imaginary, nostalgic, and otherworldly things. But you, Mari, wrote something about dreams in Aboriginal culture,
so
I think.
It's called The Dreaming. So yeah. Aboriginal culture has this super stinking cool, I guess you would call it mythology, but it's called The Dreaming. And so... And Google this, because it's been a while. But
you're like, why did you ask me about
like,
that?
I'm like, no, I took this.
I don't remember.
Well, it's so cool, and it's super beautiful. And basically, like, the dream time is, like, this creation time, and there are all of these creation myths. But the dreaming is something that happens in real time. And so the biggest equivalent I can connect it to is, like, in Norse mythology. It's, like, there are creation myths, but things are happening in real time with, like, contemporary people as well. And so I think that the piece that I wrote about for Quail Bell was about how I was like, I went to my professor and I said, like, I'm going to learn all about the dreaming mythologies. And she literally gave me this look of like, okay, white American girl, like, what are you?
Good
luck with that, because they're not, like, lexiconed anywhere, because the entire point of Dreamtime and the dreaming and these stories is that they are not accessible to everyone. So they're in Aboriginal culture, there is women's business, there's men's business, and
of course
women, yes, right,
of
and,
course,
and there is not, like, precocious white girl business. And so I was like, I want to learn all about this. And it was honestly, it was so good for me, because it was the first time, I guess it was 5 or 6 years ago, and it was the first time I had really been introduced to this idea of, like, not all stories are for everyone. Like, some people,
right.
And I feel like that's a much more popular idea now, that, like, not all spaces are for everyone, and not all stories are for everyone, and you don't always get to, like, talk over people. And at the time, it was this really honest intention to, like, learn more, and we have this impulse to respect something by learning more about it, but it was the first experience I had when someone said, no, you respect this by respecting the boundaries. And so I vaguely remember, I think the article that I wrote for Quail Bell was about how this was the first time that I had realized, like, oh, sometimes respecting these other people is just respecting that I cannot know everything I want to know about them, as opposed to, like, this, like, 90s multiculturalism that we grew up in, which is, like, learn everything! Like, learn all of the ancient stories of the Aztec people to understand, like, contemporary Mexicans. You're like, that's not...
Yeah.
Like, looking back on it now, it seems silly, but it was genuinely this first time that I think that, like, white America was really trying to figure out basically how to see minorities as, like, people, and the only way we could wrap our heads around it was to... learn everything we could. So, and Australia was great because you were either like smoking or drinking or on a beach.
So, what did you do at the community level there, or anything? What did you do that related to social justice?
So, I joined this group called the Women's Action Collective, which was it was at the University of Melbourne. And if I don't know how this recording would ever reach anyone who would have access to that, but if you do, go join it. It was the best. It was like the first, like,
when you study abroad in Australia.
When you study abroad in Australia, middle class girls from America, join it. But it was like the first experience. It was once again like the first experience that I had with kind of being told off on like a wide scale, because many liberal Australians, like, hate Americans, like, very overtly, and I don't think we ever really think about it, because Australia seems like a chill island with, like, lots of snakes, for the most
and
part.
And kangaroos!
And, like, kangaroos and
koalas.
Shit.
Koalas!
Koalas, drop bears. But I joined this collective, and it was, like, the first, this is super awesome, like, just radical feminist collective. I was like, 19 or 20, so I was first starting to identify as a feminist. And but I didn't really, I was still, like, struggling to figure out what that meant. And so we had these, like, super radical meetings, or radical to my, like, 19-year-old mind, because it was the first place I went where the group discussion involved asking people what pronouns they were comfortable with. And I, like, didn't get that, because, like, no one had told me, and so I was, like, really ignorant, and...
I mean, even still, it's relatively new in terms of mainstream, not in feminist conversations, mm-hmm. or LGBT...
But in mainstream conversations.
Yeah, in mainstream conversations, it's definitely, within the past 5 years or so,
mm-hmm.
when you look at social media now, and you compare it to social media from 5 years ago...
Yeah.
That alone is an indication that... 5 years ago, people were not asking about your personal pronoun.
Yeah. No, it's true. Like, we're moving so fast. And actually, one of my main criticisms of sort of feminism and liberal leftist ideologies in general is, like, this obsession with ideological purity.
Yeah.
And being called in as opposed to being called out. And, like, we don't all have access to all of the resources for being, like, proper, correct feminists and activists all the time. So we all make mistakes and we hurt people's feelings. And that's why I'm really a big fan of calling in as opposed to calling out, that, like, hey, listen, maybe we could consider using this other word, or maybe have you read this? And not even that we're all supposed to, like, have the same quote-unquote correct ideology, but that there's a way to have these discussions. And I know it takes so much more emotional energy, and that not everyone can manage that emotional output. I totally get that. But that when we possibly can, to try to call people in rather than out.
Yeah, because you want to be inclusive.
You
as
do.
Inclusive as possible. And that was actually something that I struggled with ever so briefly when I first submitted my application to Radio Free Brooklyn for this show, my proposal.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered, should I call it a feminist show? I'm a feminist.
Right.
I very happily identify as a feminist, but would it be quote unquote safer to call it a show that's about women's empowerment?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are many women who don't want to label themselves as feminists, but they like the idea of empowering women.
No.
And it's still, the F word is still so loaded.
Because the F word, like, cuts off dicks.
Yeah. That's the idea. We're burning bras. We're hating men.
I hate men. Like, you think you can out-hate men, but I out-hate all men on this earth.
Yeah, whereas, really, feminism is about, or should be about, including all women, all people, mm-hmm. for a more equal society, to make sure that women have the same sort of choices that men do.
Mm-hmm. I've heard criticisms of calling feminism before, and they all have some version of like, well, if feminism is really about including everyone, why does it have femme in the title? That's so women-centric. And I'm always like, men get everything else.
Yeah, can we have this?
Can we have this one thing? And I actually feel myself thinking that, like, that's one of my, like, angry mantras. Like, I have my, like, peaceful mantras that are, like, the universe is for you. Like, and everything is for you. But, like, my angry mantra is, like, why can't we have this one thing?
Yeah, and it's hard not to get angry, right?
It is. It's really so hard.
Yeah. I mean, I think every woman has experienced some level of anger. Mm-hmm. I mean, as little girls, we start to see just the way brothers and male cousins and male classmates are treated differently. Mm-hmm. Or even the way your parents might get along. Like, why is it that your mother does certain things and your dad does other things? And it seems to be like that in almost every family that you encounter growing up. Mm-hmm. And you just start getting angrier and angrier. And God, once you get to college and you learn more about friends who have been raped or sexually assaulted, or that happens to you. I mean, gosh, it could happen sooner, but unfortunately for many women, that's something that happens once they get to college. And that's mm-hmm. just, that's when we get really angry, right? Yeah. College is...
I was about to ask, like, when do you remember, like, the penny really dropping and getting really angry about it?
So, because I come from a family of sisters, mm-hmm. a family of women, and my mom is a badass. She is.
Oh, your mom is so cool. Like, I can't. I just need to pause. Like, Christine's mom is literally the coolest.
I'm not going to go into too many details about her personal life, but she is a very strong woman. And from an early age, I can't even tell you, but just as a kid, even mm-hmm. when my sisters and I were under 10, she was telling us that women should always have equal rights. Mm-hmm. Women should always have the same or similar choices. I mean, obviously, our bodies are a little bit different, mm-hmm. But our choices should be as equal to men's choices in life as possible, so that we have the same kinds of opportunities and the same kind of control over our lives. And one of the reasons why she thinks this way is because she comes from El Salvador, and she was very frustrated with machismo growing up. It was something that she wanted to escape from and never wanted her daughters to have to deal with on a regular basis. And she has so many stories of men mistreating women. We all do, but many of her stories are so overt.
Right. It,
from that time and from that place, like, she was born in 1960, and that means that she grew up, she was from the Civil War generation, so she just, yeah, has all these really strong memories of what it was like to be a woman in El Salvador and what was expected of you, especially since she came from a very traditional Catholic background mm-hmm. that made things more difficult. But yeah, just to answer your question, I started using the F word in high school. I started saying I was a feminist high school. But the idea of equality for women, women's empowerment, was something that we always talked about growing up. Mm-hmm. Like, no, you will have a baby when you want to have a baby, if you want to have a baby.
That's so good.
Will get married after you go to college, because women need an education too. Aww. Men should not be the only ones who go to college. Like, all right.
All right, got it, yes. Mom. Thank you.
And you need to be independent. You need to make sure you can take care of yourself and you don't have to rely on a man. Bum, bum, bum. Like, get all
own,
right.
Get your own dollar money. Yeah, no, you beat me to it. I remember, I definitely didn't identify as a feminist until I was like 19 or 20. And I was a super big tomboy growing up. And actually, as a child, I like didn't really understand gender very well. And I mean, I still don't. But but I was like, I like did not understand why, as a child, I couldn't be like, okay, well, I'm going to be a boy. And why people weren't just like, done, sold and sold. People were like, no, Mar, you're a girl. I'm like, but I don't. Boys get to do the things. I've seen Disney movies. I know how it works.
They get to wear overalls and climb trees. I want to do that stuff.
I don't want to sit here in a dress, you dum-dums. So growing up, and then of course you get fed all of that internalizing misogyny that you have to distance yourself from other women. And I was like always like that girl in the group of guy friends. And I really, that was my space, and, you know, later sort of came to realize how toxic and harmful a space like that can be. And so I didn't really, the penny didn't drop for me until I was like 19 or 20. And it's funny because it does, it's just like you realize that you've been fed a lie.
Yeah.
Your whole life, and you just realize like, oh, I don't have to be this way. Like, I don't have to be like nice and accommodating and sweet. Like, I can tell guys to fuck off, and I don't have to accept that I feel uncomfortable in these situations. And then I always tell this to like male friends of mine, especially ones who are younger, that are sort of coming up against feminism and they're trying to find a way to be accommodating of it, but they don't know how, because in their minds, like, all these women are angry at me and I don't know what to do.
And I want sex.
And I
want
to have sex.
Why aren't they having sex with me?
And my response is always like, you need to let those women be mad. Like, that's my only response, is not that it like, oh, just wait for it to die down, it's a phase, but like, you need to give women who are like 18, 19, 20 a chance just to be raw with that anger, because you realize that you've been fed a lie and you need to lash out, and there's no getting around that. And if you want to be a decent person, if you want to be like a decent guy to like your female friends or your girlfriend or the women in your life, my greatest advice for you is just, like, let them get through it. Let them take the time they need to be angry about something.
Yeah. I was going to back up a little bit to give another shout-out to my mother, because I love her.
She's the bomb!
she is an imperfect person, but we all are. But one of the reasons why I was comfortable using the F word in high school was because starting in middle school, she introduced me to zines.
No way! I didn't realize that. Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
So we always read in our house. There was never any question about that. Mm-hmm. But we also would go, we also traveled a lot around the country. Like, we took two cross-country trips in an RV when I was a child. And we also just drove to Florida and to Canada almost every year when I was little. Anyway, so we would visit all these different community spaces and local businesses. And along the way, my mother would just grab these materials. You know, they're
really,
like, especially at coffee shops, especially 15 years ago, you would find a lot more paper stuff. You would find more local publications. Well, in some of these college towns and some of the hippy-dippy towns that we would visit, she would find zines. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes we would go to libraries and the hippy-dippy places, she would find zines. And she was like, hey, look at these. Look, look, it looks like somebody made this. Like, somebody drew this with a marker and then photocopied it. Like, yeah. Oh, I could do this. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
So my sisters and I started reading zines, and even when we were little, we used to make comics, and we wouldn't call them zines, but, like, mini magazines for each other with pencil, like, and pen, and just, we wouldn't photocopy anything. It would just be single issue only, grab a stapler. So but when we were in middle school, that's when we went on the first, it was the summer before I started middle school. That's when we went on that first cross-country trip and really, really had exposure to all these different places. Like, zine libraries used to be more of a thing. Used to be that you could go into a small town, even, and there would be a little, like, the coffee shop might have a bunch of zines. And now, everybody has their laptop or their Kindle, and you don't see as many local newspapers and zines lying around.
But... Is that how we save the Earth?
Yeah. that's how we save the Earth from Donald Trump, who's going to kill it.
Yep. Oh.
Yep.
Let's just take a moment.
And the polar bears.
Let's just take a moment to be sad about that, all of us. Oh, man. We'll get through it, though. I am confident.
Yeah.
Or no. I'm not 100% confident. Like, I'll be really, like, bluntly honest. I'm not 100% confident, but I'm, like, 79% that if, like, we all... Now we just, like, have to put so much more effort into this. It's like, you know how Obama said that if Hillary had won, he would have just, like, handed over the keys to the White House and, like, left? Now he's like, oh, I can't, like, go to the beach in Hawaii anymore. Like, I feel like that's all of us, that we all gotta be like, all right, like, we can't just hand over the keys. Like, we can't just, like, lay back in our lawn chairs now. Like, we all have to, like, bring all that theory we've been talking about for, like, the last 8 years. We have to, like, bring that to action now and really come to the plate.
Yeah. We have to sign those petitions. We have to volunteer.
Right? You've got
to... We have to pay attention to legislation more than usual.
More than usual. You have to... Oh, you have to call your senators so much. I still call the Virginia senators because I feel... I'm like, New York, I know... Schumer, I know
you're good.
Schumer, you're doing your thing. Thank you.
Yeah.
And, like, even, I mean, Virginia senators, like, Mark Warner is still really great, but I shout out to the South. So, like, Virginia has become, like, this beacon of the South. I'm like, Virginia, I need you to, like, hold toe.
Yeah, well, it's a purple state now. It's no longer a red state.
So I know.
We can be proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, like, on election night, when the votes were coming in.
I know, I was like...
I was like, come on, Virginia, don't you fail me now.
I know, because didn't it go... I think it went red for Romney.
Yeah. Well,
like, it flip-flops.
Yes. Yeah. It did. No, and then this time around, because the rural districts always report first...
Right. Like, oh, gosh, and it just...
You're still red. Come on, Northern Virginia!
I often feel that way with Virginia, where I'm like, you are better than this.
Don't!
I raised you better.
Don't! All right, well, I think, because we have to wrap things up in a little bit, we should talk more about what we want to do on the community level here, like what we've gotten involved with here. Maybe you could talk about your cousin's temple a little bit and the services you've been going to there, and Jewish identity
in Brooklyn. Jewish identity in Brooklyn is a super interesting thing because so I lived in Israel last year. I went as part of a social justice nonprofit that worked in a largely Ethiopian community, and that did petitioning policy work for Arab education communities. So I was like in Judaism proper.
But now you're like in Judaism number two.
I'm in like Judaism number two. Like, so Israel is actually like super diverse in a way that I'm not sure is necessarily something that people who aren't Jewish like know, or it's insinuated, because Jews in America have been white people for 50, 30 years at this point. But when you go to Israel, you look around, you're like, oh, man, the diaspora, like, that was far and wide. So the Israel that I was in, it had, you know, Ashkenazi Jews and Litvak Jews, which is what my father is.
What's that?
So Litvak Jews are, like, pogrom Jews, and then Ashkenazi Jews are Holocaust Jews.
Oh, that's a very charming way to remember it.
And, you know, it's like Litvak Jews are like Eastern European, and Ashkenazi are like Germany and sort of more Western European. And then you have your Sephardic Jews, which are like North Africa and the Middle East. And then you have
Spain.
And then you have Ethiopian Jews. And you also have this like community of like Ugandan Jews. And there's like a weird like Chinese Jews community. So it's
weird.
I know. So it's like... You're like, who went there? So this whole big community in Israel. And then I come to Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is all Ashkenazi Jews for the most part. There's like a very small Sephardic Jewish community, but the company that I work for is run by Hasidim, which are the ultra-religious Ashkenazi Jews. And so it's like still being within Judaism in this very specific and interesting way. But so I am half Jewish. My father is Jewish, and then my mother is a wasp, basically.
Aww.
I know.
Aww, like, cute.
How I say affectionately, they are the When Harry Met Sally dream. but yeah, so when I came to Brooklyn, it was important to me to engage with the Jewish community in some way. And so the temple that I am beginning to become a part of is called B'nai Jeshurun, and it's in, I travel all the way up to the Upper West Side. It is not in Brooklyn. Basically because it's a very wealthy and affluent community, and so they have very, it's like going to like a big cathedral.
It's so pretty.
It's so pretty. It's like, do you want to worship in like a big beautiful house? And like, I do. Like, sometimes I just do. Like, I just want to worship in like a big beautiful house.
You're like, God definitely lives here.
I know. I'm like, God is here for sure.
And definitely.
Like, and I think these services like have a lot of Hebrew, and they have a lot of singing, and they can sort of afford to bring in all of these like really amazing musicians. And so yeah, that is part of my focus right now, is to find a way to be a part of the Jewish community in a way that is also, because the Jewish community has been here for such a frickin' long time, but the Jewish community is very insulated in Brooklyn in a lot of ways. And
what do you mean by that?
I mean that the Jewish community, okay, so we'll explain this at length in another episode, I think, because I do think it's interesting.
You got a minute, girl.
We got some. But basically, the Jewish community is a community that has never been able to trust the country it's lived in, just historically. And so the Jewish community here has its own ambulance service because for many reasons, but there's just no history of being able to trust the country that you're in. Especially for these Hasidic Jews who feel very ostracized in a lot of ways. So they are very cut off. But as someone whose father is Jewish and whose mother is not Jewish, I often feel like a bridge in those communities, which is also how I felt when I lived in Israel, in a lot of ways, of a place of intense Jewishness and non-Jewishness, and how do you make those two sides collide or come back? Collide is a little bit aggressive. To merger as a single family.
Come together. Come make love.
To make love and come together and birth many beautiful children. Yeah, so that's sort of what I am interested in right now, is finding a way to be a bridge between the Jewish community and all of the other communities in Brooklyn.
All right, well, you build that bridge, Mari Pack.
I'll build it.
Thank you for listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn. I'm Christine Stoddard, and this is my beautiful and very brilliant Mari Pack. Tune in again next week.